author of The Week on Radio Gorgeous.
Today I'm in Soho, London with Ayo Tillett-Wright. Ayo is from Manhattan, New York. He was raised there by a single-parent mother in the Lower East Side before it was gentrified. Ayo has written a memoir about growing up in a very bohemian and mostly chaotic environment. Ayo, who was named after one of Jupiter's moons, is a photographer, is a writer and a filmmaker, and has a hugely popular TED Talk called 50 Shades of Gay. The memoir is called Darling Days. Hi, and welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Firstly, I want to know what it felt like skateboarding through the streets of Manhattan as a child.
It felt like flying. I've been skating when, well, I started skating when I was 9, and I only stopped when I was about 25 or 26. I ate shit on my way to the subway, and I like hit the ground in this way where my bones ached for like 2 days afterwards, and I was like, oh, I don't have insurance. I think I probably had better stop this. I might actually be too old for this. So I stopped. But yeah, I mean, it's flying through the busiest. It's being invisible in the midst of the most eyeballs possible. And it was, yeah, my chosen form of
getting
around.
It was kind of flying, wasn't it, in a way?
Yeah.
And also running. It was a combination of many things, but on wheels. It was mm-hmm. absolutely fantastic. So I want to know, growing up in the kind of 80s and 90s, because obviously New York's changed so much.
Yeah, the New York that I grew up in is gone. The New York that I grew up in was chaos. It was where everybody who had been kicked out of somewhere else was sent to. It was the refugee camp of all of the interesting people of the world, as far as I was concerned. But, you know, there was a lot of drugs and a lot of mental illness and a lot of people that exist on the fringes of society, quote-unquote normal society elsewhere, were just, you know, I was like a little tiny human tea bag steeped in all of this every day. So,
were you aware of it being different?
No, absolutely not. Anything that you grew up in as a kid is your normal. So my normal was people who self-invented, and my normal was people who had issues and things that they dealt with, and demons, and people who nodded out on the way to the store, you know?
You were born a girl. As a child, you were the ultimate tomboy. You not only dressed like a boy, you lived as a boy. One of your big fears was being found out in the loos that you were not a boy. How did you deal with this?
Well, I definitely wouldn't have defined myself as a tomboy. The idea that I was a tomboy implies that I was a girl pretending to be a boy. I just was a boy. I lived, I think when I was like 6, I hit a point where people start to delineate between who's allowed to do what based on gender. And people started to ask me what I was. And before that, they had never had. And so I just got to live as me, which was my happiest state. And then when they decided that I couldn't play ball with them if I wasn't a boy, I was just like, well, fuck it, I'm a boy. And then at about 14, I lived full-time as a boy from 6 to 14. And then at 14, I thought, well, I moved to Germany to live with my dad in a safer environment. And I thought, I would like to have more of a normal life and more of a normal social sphere where I'm not in fear all the time. And I got hit by puberty, and I felt as though I wanted to try out being a girl, which is not your typical transgender story, I don't think at all. And I lived as a girl for a while. I was a bisexual girl, and then I was a gay girl. And then at 28, I was like, oh, wait a second. I think actually I was right when I was 5. So now the last 2 years have been taken with me being like, me dealing with the reality of what this means now. Do I transition? Does that matter? Like, are chemicals and hormones the important part? No. So yeah, dealing with being a boy with boobs, you know, and like a voice.
I like it. A boy with boobs. That could be a next book.
I will always be a boy with a girl's accent.
Yeah. In fact, one of your most interesting things about your book is your awareness of feelings. I've never read a book where so acutely your feelings came over continually. They're so strong, and you describe them amazingly. Can you talk about that? Because I find a lot of people who've had upsetting lives are not in touch with their feelings.
I wasn't either. I think I lived, as many children of addicts do, I think you stuff things because you're taking care of other people. And I'd lived a kind of forward march of a life, and I didn't make any room for an inner existence or make any room for self-reflection or self-care until I was in my mid-20s and I got really walloped by anxiety and depression. And then I had to stop and address what was going on. And right at the same time as I really got kicked in the face by depression and anxiety, I also was starting to write this book. So I then completely flipped my life upside down, got healthy, and decided to live and started walking through all of my most traumatic experiences in writing them in the first person present. So it was reliving all of these things. And then I just started upturning all of these rocks, and I scanned 2,500 of my mom's photos of me as a kid and started to realize that I had completely disconnected from little Io. But something about writing things first person present takes you into the experience in a way where I really did feel as though I was reliving it. And I went back and read all of my journals and looked at all of her photos and just like put myself in the scenario. I have a condition called synesthesia. So where the most common knowledge or the common version that most people know is when you, like if I say orange, you'll think of your mother. Or if I say, you know, coffee, you think of a pavestone or whatever. You confuse your senses. Mm-hmm. So for me, it manifests itself in super, super heavily visualized thoughts in shapes and colors. So I think that that has an effect on how I describe feelings and why there's a lot of metaphor, because I see things as shapes and colors in my head. It's very hard to explain.
Is that helpful to be an artist then? I mean, because you are a photographer, you know, so you're you're visualizing stuff.
Yeah, weirdly, photography, I was most prolific as a photographer, besides my one portrait project that I do that I don't really consider my artwork. My portraits I was taking in a period when I wasn't aware of the fact that I needed glasses, and I was shooting mostly in the dark. So in a way, it was allowing myself to see. And I'd go back and look at these photographs of these experiences that were formative and life-changing in regards to my relationship to discovering that I was gay, or that I, you know, who my community was in the world, when I couldn't necessarily be present in the moment because I was also dealing with such gnarly anxiety. I was just checking out all the time and drinking a lot. And going back and looking at the photos, now in retrospect, I can see that what I was doing was taking snapshots of moments so that I could actually experience them later.
Now, I want to talk about your mother, because the first thing in the book is a letter to your mum. And I want to explain you to explain to listeners, I know you can't really explain your relationship with her, but why did you write this letter and what's it about?
I opened the book with a letter to my mom because it would be very easy to dismiss my mom as neglectful or perhaps some people would go so far as to say abusive. But I think that that would be... those are the banner headlines on somebody who is unclassifiable, somebody who is unheadlinable. She has so many different things living so intensely within her, and I see so much tenderness in this woman who is also a human bull, you know, and I see so much softness in this person that has survived every hardship and walks through the universe like a spear. So it's just, she's so multifaceted, and I know... deeply know that my mom, for everything that she messed up and everything that she slipped on, you know, not there not being food, there being no consistency, her being an addict, her having rage fits and saying awful shit to me, she never intended to hurt me. And the idea that she would have ever hurt me is devastating to her. And there's this dissonance between what she did and what she intends that I can understand when I understand the traumas that she's experienced. The love of her life was murdered 2 years before I was born in this really brutal, abrupt, sudden way by the police in New York in the 80s when poor people didn't have any recourse. They still don't, but there was far less recourse at that point without the internet and the ability to garner social media. And he was ripped from her, and it completely ruptured her life. And that is not something, that's not a damage. So I didn't grow up with this expectation that she was just going to snap into motherhood. So in writing this book, I knew I hadn't yet given her the manuscript, and I knew that she was going to read it and it was going to cause her suffering, and I didn't want her to suffer. So I wrote this letter to her so that she would understand where I was coming from. And then I realized, oh, I've got it included in the book so that the reader, before they get into their own judgments or before they start projecting their own lives and their own mothers onto this character, I want them to understand that I come from a place of forgiveness and a desire to understand rather than an indictment.
No, it really is very, very, very moving. Your mother was obsessed by dance, but in no way was she typical homey mom. She was unlike any mother. She was not prepared to compromise her lifestyle in any way. you had to fit in with her. I mean, can you just describe a kind of typical day when you were about 5 or 6?
I'd say things really changed when I was 7. So I'll give you an average day when I was like 8 or 9 would be we'd have gotten home. Yeah, I'm going to start at the top of the day, which would be we'd get home at about 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, go to sleep. I didn't have a bed. I slept on an army cot that was an old like military cot that it didn't have the two poles at the end to hold it together. So if you moved at all, it would clap up around you. No, I know. And I had a couple of hoodies stuffed into a pillowcase for a pillow. And I wasn't allowed to close my door. So I'd go to sleep in my room and my mom would be in the other room, sometimes drunk, sometimes not. The radio was always on, so there wasn't any like peace or quiet or solace in the house. And then we'd wake up at whatever 20 minutes before we were supposed to be halfway across the city, I'm sure. And it would usually start with a screaming match between us because she wanted me to get up and I didn't want to get up because I was tired and I was a little kid. And then I'd get up and we'd start walking, and we walked everywhere. And when I was 10, for example, I went to a school that was literally on the other side of the island of Manhattan from where we were, and she was always late for things. And I describe in the book how people at this private school would take me less seriously because I was always late for things, and I could watch them giving up on me, but I was always late because somebody else was always late, and it was really infuriating to me. But we would walk the entire island of Manhattan several times a day, partially because we couldn't afford to take the subway, but partially because that was just how she did it. She was devoted to being active and alive and feeling the world and being out in the wind and the sun. And then I'd get out of school and I'd spend the day in a classroom of people trying to figure out what I was. And in that particular school,
that was a stage school, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was an acting, that was a school for performers. And you had to pay for your meals, and I didn't have any money to pay for my meals, so I would eat ice cream and I would go play basketball with famous actor kids. And I eventually got kicked out of there too. And then I'd get out of school and generally go to one dance class or another, if not three, and go to an audition, and then probably go to a rehearsal for some shitty play that I was in some church basement somewhere, and do it all over again, and then have a performance or not, and get home at 12:30 or 1,
and
start over.
You were always hungry. That's one of the most moving things in the book.
I mean, saying I was always hungry is unfair. I wasn't, you know, my mom didn't starve me. She just didn't eat herself. So there wasn't something like our lives. Most people's lives are really built around meals.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, totally.
And families coming together and eating together. And we didn't have that at all. We didn't even have a table to sit at. And half the time electricity wasn't on. So the fridge wasn't on. And there certainly wasn't anything in it. So food wasn't a centrifugal force in our lives. And it just didn't really happen all that often.
You fantasized about food a lot, didn't you?
Yeah. Mm. Well, yeah, you're hungry, and everybody around you is eating McDonald's Happy Meals. You really want a Happy Meal.
And then your mother was obsessed in a good way of kind of eating healthily.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you know, you'd sneak off and have candy and stuff, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, any parent that actually wants their child not to eat sugar should give them some.
Yeah.
Because otherwise they're going to figure out how to get it. It's very easy to come by. You can buy it without any age limits.
Yeah, you're gonna start one of the few things in America you can buy.
No shit. And you're going to start stealing people's money and using it to buy candy and ho-hos and Drake's cupcakes and shit, which I totally did.
RadioGorgeous.com.
You mentioned your dad. You went to go and live in Germany. And then the family decided, this is your dad's side, who are kind of very wealthy. Well, they seemed it in the book. They decided to send you to an English boarding school, which I found very amusing. But it wasn't kind of the English boarding school you imagine. It sounded like a free school.
Well, yeah, and the family actually didn't have much to do with the decision. And they weren't particularly wealthy. They just owned a nice house on the Upper East Side.
They had a normal life.
Yeah, they had a nice house, but they weren't wealthy. But yeah. It was my dad's decision because I was living in Germany with him, and unbeknownst to me, he was also addicted to drugs. And I started fighting with his girlfriend, and he was entirely unprepared to take custody of me. And I was living in an attic by myself at a certain point, and then I got kicked out of my school, and I think he was just kind of at his wit's end. And so he found a boarding school in England that was this very hippy-dippy place with a very small number of students, and he was like, Io, it's all about questioning. And I was like, cool, questioning the rules? Yeah, no, I got there, and it was about questioning yourself. But They kicked me out. They were afraid that I would start a revolution amongst the student body because I would constantly call them out on things that I saw as unjust that they were doing. And they were right, judging by where I'm at in my life now, to kick me out for fear that I would start a revolution, because I totally would have. And then I got sent back to live with my mom, which was the only option. She was the only person who had a house I could fit into as a teenager.
You got on quite well, though, when you went back, though, didn't you? Didn't it kind of settle down a bit?
No, it got much worse.
Oh, no.
No, it got drastically worse. That's when everything got really, really dark.
Wasn't there another girl living there as well, though?
Yeah, my best friend moved in after a couple of years, but when I got back, she had been broken by my departure, by me getting taken away, and she started dating a physically abusive guy who was also an alcoholic, and she had just gone down the rabbit hole. So when I got back is when things started to get, like, we didn't hit each other, but things got physically violent around the house, and she got, you know, locked in the hospital several times and would show up bleeding from the head and not know what happened to her. And, you know, things were very dark in a different way when I came back.
And then you were growing up as well, so you were becoming a rebellious teenager and you were beginning to drink and do all those things, weren't you?
Yeah, and a lot of the times in New York, if you don't want to be in your house, the only other option is a bar or a club, you know. So I was like 17, 18, 19, discovering psychedelics, discovering sex, trying to figure out what my sexuality was, and I was pretty much like, oh, you can walk? Let's figure it out. And surprisingly, I never got sick, which is just a miracle. But yeah, I started doing a lot of drugs and hanging out with people that were a waste of time.
Yeah. Haven't we all done that?
Yes, we have.
I think it's called growing up.
I think in New York and in London and Paris and bigger cities, you just do it much earlier, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So. So I could not put your book down. Your writing is so original, fresh, and I was entranced by your honesty.
Thank you for saying that, because the writing is the part that means the most to me. Actually, me personally. I spend a lot of time talking about what I hope this book contributes to the world, and that is obviously of utmost importance to me, but to me on a like very personal level, when it's just to about my own wishes, that is the thing that I care about the most, is that I did the best that I could with the writing.
Now, your writing is beautiful. So are you writing it presently?
I've submitted a proposal for a new book, which is about my mom's love story with Billy and his murder and what happened. And it's kind of juxtaposed between her telling of what happened then and their relationship and her life and my present day investigation of what actually happened to him. Which will catch a reader up a little bit on what's happened in my life since. Not fully, but a little bit. And I just want to give people the experience that I have had of understanding where my mom comes from so that she can have a little bit more of her own voice.
So tell me about your mom now. What's she up to?
She's exactly the same. My mom still lives on the same block, and she...
Without the light. That's what worried me most.
Yeah, she still unfortunately doesn't have enough sunlight, and she works for jobs that don't pay her particularly well and still performs and still does her poetry. And
I'd love to know how old she is.
She would kill me if I told you that. She would send a heat-seeking missile from New York City on instinct and blow my head off.
I like that, because that's still very old-fashioned, isn't it?
Every year for the last 10 years, she's gotten younger on her birthday. So last year, she turned 2. The year before that, she turned 8. The year before that, she's question mark.
Okay, question mark. No, I'm just, you know, just intrigued. So what's been the response to your book? Has it been published? It's been released obviously in England now, UK, but what about in the States? What's been the response?
I don't want to jinx it, but I haven't gotten a bad review
Touch
yet.
Wood.
I know. Yeah. I haven't gotten a bad review yet, but I'm very honored and very floored and very, feel like I've stumbled back people that I've looked up to my whole life, and I feel very, honored to have someone sit here and tell me that my writing is enthralling for them. You know, I'm just very grateful.
Io, Darling Days, thank you so much. Darling Days is a memoir and it's published by Virago and it's out now. And thank you so much for coming to London, coming to Soho, and coming onto Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2016. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.